Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I'm looking forward to our conversation. Our guest is a return guest and somebody who I'd love to have on because he has such a fund of knowledge, but more importantly, the ability to explain it and discuss it in terms that everybody can understand. Today I want to welcome back Mr. Carl Streitel. He's a retired teacher. He taught English high school and finance for 19 years. And now he works as a freelance editor and tutor. He can be contacted at KS Editing at opayq.com and via his Substack, The Mental Lab, at mentallab.substack.com. So Mr. Streitel, I wanted to thank you so much for spending time with us today because we had this conversation before, but school is one of, obviously as a doctor, it had to be one of my favorite things. And everything that I'm hearing about the education system is just me going in the wrong direction. And you wrote an article, Two Ways the School Complex Muzzles Parents and Students. And I wanted to get your opinion about where do you think the state of our education system is? And down the road, I like to talk about, again, solutions, how parents can really take their power back and have control once again. And am I wrong? First of all, are parents losing control of their children? That wasn't the case when I was a student. Is that a place that we need to start from so we can understand where we are right now?
Well, first of all, you gave me quite a bit to chew on there. First of all, thank you so much for having me back. As I mentioned before we went on air, it's always a pleasure to speak to both you and to your audience. So once again, I always welcome that opportunity. So thank you. Regarding your questions there, I think one of the issues, and it ties in directly with the last item that you mentioned, the question that you asked, which was related to, you know, parents and losing control of their children. I think it's important to start off by differentiating, though, between school and education. And I think one of the main problems that has occurred over time, in my opinion, is the marriage, the unholy matrimony of those two, and where they become almost synonymous. And for many people, they are synonymous. That, you know, I'm sure there might be several people even in your audience sitting there right now listening to this saying, why is he repeating himself? School and education, right? They're interchangeable. They're the same thing. But truly, they couldn't be more different. And especially as the compulsory school system has grown in this country and around the world, they, in an ironic way, the closer they get to each other in the compulsory school system, the farther apart they are in terms of their goals. And if I'm making sense by saying that, I'll try to think about that for a moment if I'm phrasing that accurately. But I mean, education, learning, I think of those two things as synonymous, education and learning. And of course, that's what happens every day, right? That's what happens naturally. That doesn't require a teacher. Now, a teacher may be involved in some way, but obviously we all learn on a daily basis from every single thing that we do, right? Every piece of information that our senses are taking in, we're using and our mind is computing and we're learning from. And that's one of the great joys, in my opinion, of being human, is that ability to learn and that ability to take in that information and to make critical decisions using that. Now, school can play into that in various ways and has throughout much of modern human history in any way. But as soon as those two things become completely and utterly intertwined, and especially as soon as force enters into it, then what we see is the loss of education and the rise of school. School in terms of a bureaucracy, school in terms of a structure that basically exists, like I stated in my article, to perpetuate itself. You know, like most things government, like most things large, even in the private sector too, they exist to continue themselves, to perpetuate themselves. And that is a true problem. Now, to bring that back to your question in terms of the, you know, parents' control or perhaps a different term, parents' involvement in the lives of their children. Yes, I think that that the growth of this bureaucratic school system has much to do with that. However, I do want to make clear, and you know, I don't mind stepping on toes anymore these days, because I think it's important to tell the truth, like Thomas Sowell says, if you want to help yourself, you tell people what they want to hear. If you want to help other people, you tell them the truth. And I think here, one of the issues is that parents have quite a bit of culpability in this as well, that they have allowed this to happen. And many continue to allow this to happen. They've allowed the outsourcing of basically raising their children to the educational industrial complex, which is more than happy to take on that role, because it means that now they have the control, right? They can mold the children in their image instead of in your image, right? In your family's image, that they can provide the principles of their own choosing and then have those supersede your family's principles. And, you know, as parents want to enter, you know, continue to be in the workforce and, you know, make more money and have certain lifestyles, then they offload the raising of their children to government schools in many cases. And so I think that there is, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around, but I just want to be clear that I think that, you know, the school system is happy to take that responsibility and control wherever it can, but it's also part and parcel of something that parents have allowed and continue to do. Now, thankfully, we do see some parents starting to push back against that with the, you know, the rise of homeschooling and alternative schools and things like that. So let me pause there. I apologize, but I just wanted to make clear sort of the groundwork from which I'm approaching things.
No, I think that you're right. There's this willingness, I think, throughout society, really, to have somebody take care of you. And somebody should be, they know more than you do. They have, you cede your control to them. And that goes in healthcare as well, you know, where people are basically doing the I wouldn't say the bidding, but perhaps all these drug company commercials, it's like this dance-offs and all these cute music and people come in asking for the drug, for example, but they don't really, there's no thought behind it. What about fixing the problem? And, you know, you mentioned, you know, personal responsibility is, to me, a very important thing. Are we at a point, and I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, where if parents want to take the control of raising their child back, can they? I mean, this has become such a grid where you have all these social services, healthcare services, mental services, their clinics, all these things integrated in the school, where it was just, you know, 9 to 3 or whatever your time was, and you were done. People are staying there much longer. As you mentioned last time you were on the show, it's almost like they're living in the school and they just go home for a break. So are we in a position now where can parents take their child's power back?
Thankfully, absolutely. Yes. I mean, if there's, you know, the rays of hope that are starting to shine in, we have more and more opportunities, and people are, you know, thankfully we have some amazing entrepreneurs around this country and just and around the world, and just absolutely amazing people who truly do care about students and want to help them in whatever ways they can, have found just myriad different ways to offer and to help parents to regain that control. And I think that that's an important factor, because as you pointed out, in medicine and so many other facets of our society, people are more than willing to abdicate that control to the quote unquote experts, which, well, we saw where that got us, you know, just a few years ago now, which not all that great. So I think it's time to start maybe questioning the experts a little bit, but recognizing that asking for help and accepting help and seeking out help is not the same thing as abdicating responsibility. That we need to recognize, I think, that it's okay to accept other people's experience, other people's wisdom, other people's assistance in gaining the goals that we want, especially for our children and for ourselves, and that we think that hopefully are going to lead us to better lives and our children to better lives. So I'm certainly not opposed to accepting assistance in that way, but I want to phrase it very carefully, where, again, it's not just I'm going to foist my kid off on a public school, but now I'm going to take my kid out of public school and foist him or her off on a private school. Well, that's no different, right? You didn't do anything there to regain control as a parent. And let me use a different word too, to steal one from you, Dr. George, which is responsibility, right? It's not that it's the control of the parent, it's the responsibility of the parent. And excuse me, I think that's a very important key to keep in mind, that right, you and I and others chose to have children. That means that we did not bring a child into this world to become a burden to others, right? We brought a child into this world because we wanted to have responsibility for that child, to raise that child, and hopefully to mold that child into somebody of character who's going to not only live a good life, but is going to help others to live a good life as well. So it's a matter of taking that personal parental responsibility. And to circle back to your question of, is it possible? Absolutely. And arguably, in the era, at least of modern large bureaucratic schools, it's never been easier. You know, it was much easier in like 1750, sure. But today we have a variety of options and just around the entire country, beyond just homeschooling, because I think sometimes people fall into that bifurcation of, well, it's either my kids are either going to be in a school, whether it's private or public, all day, or they're going to have to be homeschooled. And then, you know, I'm going to have to stay home from work and, you know, we're going to have to upend our lives and all this. And that's certainly an option. And believe me, I am a gigantic proponent of homeschooling. I think that there is no one more qualified to teach your children than you, especially when it comes to morals, ethics, and character, arguably the most important subject, quote unquote, that one can teach children. But I do recognize that doesn't work for everybody. And that's a good thing to keep in mind, right? There is no one size solution. There is no panacea for these things, but there are many, many options out there. And the burgeoning micro school movement is, I think, one of those that I hope everyone can at least investigate, regardless of whether you use that or not. And I know in previous episodes I mentioned, and I'll just mention them again here just to give people a little bit of a place to look on the internet. You have networks like Acton Academy, ACTON, and Prenda, PRENDA, among others that have schools across the country and just are doing amazing things when it comes to education and helping children grow as people, not as automatons. So yes, I do think that there are many opportunities for parents to be able to find ways to regain the responsibility that they used to have and I believe should have.
Well, you actually just taught me something. I was one of those people who thought it's, you know, one or the other. I'm really happy to know that there's such a gradation of variety in between. Now, in your article, you mentioned that the system tries to propagandize children and parents to believe that government education is what? The end all be all, the only thing game in town, the way to equalize us. What are they trying to propagandize people to believe? It seemed to have changed. I mean, at one point it was all about social, what is it? I forgot what it's called now because I've just totally left my mind. But just making social construct changes, gender equality, all this other stuff. What are they trying to do in education, do you think, as the underpinning of why that exists? Obviously, it's a bureaucracy. It's a money-making venture for somebody somewhere. But what are they trying to corral people into, in your opinion?
Mm-hmm. And because the system is so complex and because it is so bureaucratic and multi-layered, I think that question, the answer to that question will vary depending on about whom we happen to be speaking. You know, for example, if I asked an average classroom teacher my basic experience in the educational system, what's your goal, you know, on a given Tuesday, let's say, I'm going to get one answer, right? And it's probably going to have nothing to do, most likely have nothing to do with the underpinnings of the system itself. And likewise, I think if you ask individuals throughout the different levels of the system, whether principals or even state bureaucrats who are involved in you know, determination of educational policy and things like that, I doubt that anyone's going to give you a list of the eight lessons. I think it was eight or nine lessons, you know, that John Taylor Gatto pointed out of what teachers actually teach. So I think it's important also to keep in mind what do people think they're doing and what is actually going on under the surface, right? Sort of, I suppose, almost like parasitically coming along with, you know, for the ride, it's sort of being snuck in along with the lessons in history and reading Julius Caesar and things like that. And of course, it's those lessons that I'm much more interested in and that I'll talk about a little bit here, because we're all familiar with the superficial lessons. And again, by superficial, I mean the ones that we can see, right? The lessons when we sit down and we learn how to add, subtract, multiply, and we're doing experiments in chemistry. But it's those, the hidden lessons, I think, that are the truly impactful ones. So for example, I would point out that, again, in my experience, I maybe this has changed, and I'm sure some people do this differently, but it was rare for me to see anywhere across the school where anybody was really going to have a lesson that would seriously question U.S. hegemony or, you know, the U.S. as an empire, right? The idea that, well, it's the U.S.'s job to go around the world and to be the world's policeman and protect democracy and, you know, all those things that we hear in the news every day that, you know, the government wants us to believe. And I fell hook, line, and sinker for that myself. You know, it took me over 30 years to start questioning those narratives. And, you know, even after 9/11 and everything, I wouldn't say that I was, you know, as gung-ho as some people were. I obviously didn't join the military and, you know, go over to Iraq and Afghanistan, but I didn't really have a problem with what was going on and I didn't really question anything. And we see that, you know, pretty much everything we were ever told about that was a complete lie. And, you know, that's not something that, again, in my experience, maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe this has changed. But when I was teaching, I don't recall any of my students ever, you know, mentioning anything about how, oh yeah, we learned about how they lied to us about weapons of mass destruction or anything like that, right? It was just, let's, again, you know, the teacher isn't standing up there saying America is great, but that is the message, right? That is the underlying message, that there's something noble about, you know, just these lines on the map. You know, there's something special about that. And okay, fine, you know, believe that or don't believe that, but the bottom line is there's no critical thought going on behind it. So I think that that is one key lesson that comes along with everything else that goes on in a public school, which is don't really think too critically. And I think that it's important to add that qualifier to the too critically, because we can pretend like there's some critical thought going on. But if you think too critically, if you get off, you know, if you leave that 3x5 card of allowable opinion, you break outside of that Overton window, then you're generally going to be hammered down, right, as the tall nail. And I saw that in class discussions very often when we would have a speaker come to the school, and usually it was about some DEI related topic, which I know you were mentioning before. And, you know, then we would have a quote unquote open discussion in our classrooms afterwards, but there was nothing open about it. You know, we were given the talking points to ask these questions. And you know, if you were a student sitting there among 25 of your peers in high school, number one, just the social pressure that's already on you in that situation. And, you know, what are you going to do at that point too, when the teacher is asking these very directed questions of you as well? They're not open-ended, like, should we even have this speaker? You know, why are we doing this? You know, things like that. It was all agreement with what that speaker was talking about previously. So I think that is one of those lessons that goes on too. Now, you know, what else is taught, and why else do, you know, schools or how else do they perpetuate themselves? I think that also, you know, what's taught is that teachers are experts, and that not just are they experts, but they are a required element of learning. And just take a very simple physical example of what happens if a teacher is 5 minutes late to a class. right? I mean, we can all kind of picture that. I'm sure we've been students in a classroom outside college, you know, in elementary school, middle school, high school, when a teacher was late to a class. Well, what happens? You know, in my experience, it was either, you know, depending on the other mixture of kids in the class, it could be complete bedlam, you know, like kids hanging from the rafters. But generally it was, you know, kids just like sitting there having conversations with their friends, right? Or people near them. It wasn't like, well, why can't we start learning on our own? You know, it wasn't like I sat there and opened a textbook or, you know, got onto a laptop and started learning. It was, well, learning can only start, and I really only want learning to start when the teacher's in here. I mean, what was one of the greatest times in college was when the professor would say, oh, class is canceled, you can stay home. Well, you know, I probably had the same reaction to that as most people did, which was awesome. That's great. I'm so glad I can pay for not going to class. Isn't that awesome? And yeah, at the time it was. But that also goes to show what I was talking about before, that there is a gigantic divergence between learning, education, and school. And that's another lesson that kids learn in school, which is, well, learning isn't fun, right? I mean, we're going to pretend like it is, you know, and maybe it felt like that a little bit in elementary school, but education, school, learning are tough. They're difficult. And we decide whether you have learned or not, right? You need an external arbiter to be able to tell you whether you have learned or not. And you need to meet that person's goal, not your own, right? You don't have personal goals to meet, but you have to meet these arbitrary external goals too. And of course, that helps to perpetuate the entire system around it, which is, you know, based on arbitrary numbers and arbitrary goals. And it helps prepare students for the, you know, the world of, let's say, arbitrary speed limits and arbitrary age limits and arbitrary income limits when it comes to taxes and things like that, right? Like, and when we say, oh, you have to pay your fair share. Well, fair share based on what? That the politicians voted on this year that was different than last year? Like, so it wasn't fair last year, but now it's fair? I mean, you know, just like they changed the speed limit. So what, it wasn't safe before, but now it is? Is it going to be safe next year when they change it again? So, you know, there's that arbitrary nature too, where we're taught to constantly look to those quote unquote experts to guide us. And we couldn't possibly know for ourselves what's right and what's wrong. So sorry, that's a lot of information, I know, and a lot of different lessons, but I mean, there are so many mixed in there, but I hope that those are some pertinent ones anyway.
Well, they're quite, because they're baseline examples. So, you know, part of the spark of learning was being able to get something and run with it, right? So you finally understand a concept and you're able to apply it. There's no application. There's no spark in this system. It's just meet a benchmark, you know, teach to a test. There's no color in this thing. I mean, you're just, it's rote, it's memory, it's test taking over and over again, assessments, right? Data. I don't remember doing that many assessments. You know, obviously I think we did an IQ test. I'm pretty sure we did. We did preparing for SAT and that sort of thing, but it wasn't testing like that all the time. So am I correct that there's a lot of benchmark testing that goes on, whether it's social, behavioral, in addition to school?
Absolutely. I think everything is based on, in the government school system at least, and in most private schools too, is based almost entirely on testing of one form or another, whether it's standardized testing or just individual classroom testing. Those are always the benchmarks. I mean, you know, outside of, I think elementary schools are kind of a caveat to that, just because I know, like, my wife teaches in an elementary school, and, you know, their report cards are a little bit more in depth. You know, they have things for, I'll say, citizenship and things like that. I don't know if they actually call it that, but, you know, they have many, many different elements on there, many of them beyond academics, many of them, you know, personal and things like that, you know, behavioral, those sorts of things that that they're measuring students. But again, it all comes back to testing in one form or another. And with that, mixed in with the testing, then is also to go back to those arbitrary benchmarks, that idea that, are you on track? I can't tell you how many times I hope I never hear that expression again in my life. So I'll try to refrain from using that again. But this idea that, are you on pace with some generic average, you know, that's again been determined by other people, outside of you as a human being. And so it continues to come back to, and I'm going to use this term not in a hyperbolic way, and I hope your audience recognize that, like, I truly believe this, that when I say things like that dehumanize students, they dehumanize kids and adults too, but we're talking about specifically children. I mean, I truly believe that. And I know that. I've seen it. I've done it. And I mentioned this on a previous episode when we spoke. That's one of the greatest regrets of my life, that I was a part of that system and helping to dehumanize so many students through those methods. But yes, testing is such a big part of that. And again, it really reinforces that idea for students that they're never quite good enough and they always have to wait for somebody else to pick out what the goal is and to determine whether or not they've met it. And, you know, to me, one of the greatest failings of school today, and again, I'll expand that to include most private schools as well, anything that follows a traditional school model, in my opinion, fails to do the most important thing when you're teaching kids, teaching anybody, which is individualization. I mean, it just seems so obvious. I think so anyway. Yet no traditional school does that because they can't. Right? I mean, how is a high school going to individualize for 500, 1,000, 2,000 kids? How's that going to happen? How's an elementary school going to individualize for 100 kids? I mean, that's crazy, right? I mean, as someone who taught, you know, I had small classes of sometimes 12 or 13 and large classes sometimes of 30. Even with 12 or 13, individualizing is, I won't say impossible, because maybe, you know, there's somebody amazing out there who can do it. I couldn't do it. I could not individualize even for 12 or 13 kids. And so what are we asking kids to do? Well, we're asking them basically to conform, and that way it's easier for us as well, because we know we can't individualize, so we're not even going to ask you to be individuals. And then look, hey, we're all happy and we can all meet our benchmarks. Right? And then what do we end up with? Right? We end up with basically the middle, the median student, but we can wrap it up with the facade of saying things like individualized education, or even calling it things like individualized education plans, IEPs, which don't do anything, you know, in my opinion, except, you know, occasionally give kids extra time on a test, or, you know, reduce the number of answer choices on a test. But hey, look at that, right? We're back to test taking again. And, you know, what's the most important thing, as opposed to what so many micro schools do, which is the very first day when kids go in there, excuse me, even before they get in there as part of their, you know, enrollment procedure, is to determine and to actually work with the children and the parents to determine what it is they want to learn, how they're going to learn, and to have the kids set individual goals for themselves. And so we don't need to worry about, well, you know, Johnny isn't reading, and every, you know, 92% of six-year-olds should be reading at this point. Well, who cares? Right? Like, well, why does that matter for Johnny, and why should there be extra pressure on him to meet some arbitrary goal? Right? What if Johnny's doing just fine playing with, you know, in a Rector set, and, you know, learning how to work with his hands at that point? You know, do we really believe that he's going to be 35 years old and not reading? Like, no, I don't think that's the case at all. So, you know, by putting these arbitrary deadlines on kids that come along with the arbitrary testing that you were discussing, I think all that does is just reinforce that dehumanization and treat every kid basically the same, regardless of what the advertising for the school might indicate.
I think you said something really powerful, and you're saying that you teach to the median or you end up with an outcome. But I don't even know if it's the median. I think it's the lowest common denominator now.
Yes.
So we have kids entering college, and we're talking high-end schools, you know, very competitive schools, Ivy League schools, example, and they can't do the work when they get in there. I don't care what socioeconomic strata they're coming from or whatever their color is, they can't do the work. So whatever they're doing in this phase of education, this indoctrination platform, it's not working. So obviously it can't be about education if people can't do the basic, they can't write a paper, they can't put together structured sentences. You have all this AI stuff coming in there where people are usually using that to write. I don't think they even know vocabulary or spelling at this point. That's a plus. But where is the stopgap on this? I don't think this is the education system is flagging this. It doesn't seem like there's anything that's saying to the structure that is currently there that something's wrong. We're not producing citizens who can be gainfully employed, think for themselves. I would think that something is flagging this, but there's nothing. I don't see a change. I see doubling down. Do you?
Yes, I think that doubling down takes different forms. And I know we discussed this a little bit last time I was on, but I think one of the problems with having a compulsory school system and compulsory, once again, as I mentioned in the article, I mean in two ways. It's compulsory attendance and compulsory funding. And it's those two elements of compulsion that work together to be this unholy trinity, or excuse me, this, you know, unholy duality here. So part of the problem of having this compulsory system is that you have a bunch of different people demanding quote unquote results. You know, you have parents, you have teachers, you have state bureaucrats, you have community members, whether they have children in the school or not, who are demanding these results, 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 results. Now, part of that problem is you have a bunch of people who don't have any or very little stake in the outcome for the student. I mean, arguably the only one who has a real outcome, you know, a stake in the outcome for the student is the student, him or herself, especially as we go onwards in grades and ages. You know, a community member, I as a community member, I don't want any say, you know, in what Janie and Johnny as individuals are learning. Frankly, I don't think that I have any right to that. And just like I don't think that they have any right to my money, but I don't want to have any power over what somebody else's children are learning. They're not my children. So I think that that's a problem right there, that you have all these cooks in the kitchen, so to speak, who are demanding results. But by the same token, if you ask, you know, people from each of those different stakeholder groups, well, what do you mean by results? You're probably going to get different answers, right? I mean, like you just mentioned specifically in your mind, what you think results are, and that would be, you know, the ability to be gainfully employed and the ability to, you know, potentially if you choose to do so, to go on to college and to be able to at least, you know, meet the basic requirements of college, right? And I think those were the two that you mentioned in terms of, you know, what you think quote unquote results or learning would look like. Okay, fine. But obviously not everyone is going to agree with that, right? That, I mean, I tend to agree, especially with the, you know, the gainful employment part, but, you know, for each individual learner and his or her parents, the results quote unquote might be something different. And they have very few opportunities, I should say. It's not that they don't have any, but they have very few opportunities to be able to really carve out their own definitions of results without the force and the input from and the demands of these external stakeholders. And so I think that that's, you know, an element of it too. And so when you have everybody going through this same cattle chute, basically, and especially when there's all this external pressure that everyone has to go to college, and, you know, that's the only real quote unquote pathway to, you know, to a good life, then, you know, sure, we're going to continue to have a bunch of people in college you know, whatever the percentage might be, 40, 50, you know, 60% maybe, who don't really want to be there and probably shouldn't be there and are just loading themselves up with unnecessary debt, but enriching the schools, you know, while they do that. So I think that's another big problem when you have all these cooks in the kitchen who are able to, you know, have input in one way or another in terms of the direction that an individual student should or should not go. And, you know, so I think that's, to me, that's one of the biggest reasons that we see a bunch of watering down, so to speak, of college curricula and things like that, because it would have to be that way, right? I mean, you can't have below average kids, academically speaking, being able to go through that, the older curricula at these colleges, you know, when it used to just be, you know, the top 5, 10, 20% academically. Well, now if you're down to, you know, the top 70 or 80% academically, well, they have to water things down. Otherwise, you know, they're going to lose 90% of the kids halfway through freshman year. And they obviously don't want that because, number one, it, you know, it just looks bad for them. And of course, they'd be happy to have kids stay there for 8 years, you know, with tuition at 60 grand a year. So I do think that there's sort of those interdependent elements at play there.
Well said. Let's take our first break because I want to change the direction to more solution-based, because you have a ton of them. And so I want to make sure we hit them before the end of the show. So let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living a Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Carl Streitel, and you can read what he writes on, he writes for the Mises Institute. He also has mentallab.substack.com. And before the break, you did a wonderful job of really laying out what this system is about. I mean, I'm no longer in it. It seems very foreign to the way I learned. And I just wanted to try to understand what's going on. And you did a wonderful job of bringing us up to speed. So my question now, you know, we've had this centralization and this power grab. It seems to me that micro schools and other methods of teaching are the way out of this. I don't think the government is anything with power. It's not going to give it up lightly. So before we see the end of the Department of Education, which I don't know if will ever happen, it means parents and students need to start finding alternate paths. If this doesn't suit them, they need to move away from it. And from what you described, there's plenty of things that fit whatever you like. So the micro schools are one, and those are private entities, correct? Are they corporate driven? Are they teachers who've started them up themselves, a combination of everything above?
Yeah, it's very much a broad term. So I don't know percentage wise, but the majority to whom I've spoken are just individuals. They're not associated with any larger entities, corporations, anything like that. They were just individuals, oftentimes teachers, usually parents, who just were looking for a different opportunity, oftentimes just for their own children. And it just grew from there.
Gotcha. And you meant about the other types of education that you mentioned. So micro schools are one, but what else exists out there? Just a broad view.
Sure. And so I think that just to mention a couple other terms. So like I said, micro school is a very broad term. And so sometimes people will refer to that as other types of schools, such as alternative education, alternative learning, things like that. There are also hybrid models. There are also homeschool co-ops, which I think is a very exciting and a great way to use homeschooling, because obviously for many people, homeschooling can be intimidating for a variety of reasons. But I know in just listening to parents voice their concerns outside of just the, you know, the basic financial concerns that, you know, hey, somebody has to be here all day, are usually social concerns that my child is going to be isolated in some way, you know, is going to be some kind of weirdo. And obviously that generally depends on you, right? And your child, it's not like it's a given in any way. And arguably the socialization in most public schools is far worse, probably than what's going on in your home. I would hope anyway that, you know, your home is hopefully a safer place than most public schools. So at any rate, homeschool co-ops, I think, are just a great sort of hybrid between just pure homeschooling where, you know, you're with the kids all day, every day, and being able to get the kids out to experience more group activity. So basically what often happens with a homeschool co-op is they're generally local groups, oftentimes with other homeschool families, and oftentimes people from the community are involved in them as well. Maybe, you know, artisans, you have business people, people like that, who are going to come and get involved in the co-op as well. And so usually what will happen is maybe one day a week, 2 days a week, students and parents too. That's one of the nice things about these models is parents are usually much, much more involved, and they're usually asked to be much more involved too than they would be in a public school. We'll go to oftentimes an external location, you know, maybe a local church or another gathering place, a park, something like that. And they'll have a get together basically. And oftentimes that will involve some kind of learning, some kind of education. Maybe like I said, maybe somebody from the community is going to be teaching, you know, some woodworking skills that day or something like that. And it's just a great opportunity to get kids out and about, working with other people outside of their family, and of course, interacting with the community as well. And so I think that that's a fantastic model, and different co-ops do different things, but I think that's a great sort of hybrid model that a lot of parents can use. Also, I would mention sort of as an overarching idea, because a lot of micro schools will do this, is, you know, the power of the internet is just amazing when used for good. I mean, certainly we can spend our time scrolling all day, but you know, when we use it for learning, it, you know, it's all of human knowledge, right? In the palm of our hand, which is just amazing. So the idea that, you know, what frustrated me oftentimes when I was a teacher was a student and I would have some kind of personality conflict. And I wanted that student to be able to learn from someone with whom he or she did not have a personality conflict. Like, why would that not just be a common sense thing, right? Why do we have to do square peg, round hole all the time? So, you know, one of the great things with all of these options is, generally speaking, you can pick and choose from whom you're learning. And that's where technology can really come into play. If I don't like the way Khan Academy explains something, I can go to 1,000 different websites to learn about that same concept explained in probably 1,000 different ways, you know, with nuance and different examples, and just hearing, you know, different tones of voice sometimes, right? It's all that matters. You know, sometimes people just don't like my voice, right? Or maybe they prefer mine to somebody else's, but right, things like that, that we know are important in learning. And so to come back to your question in terms of the different varieties, I just wanted to mention, because it can't just be like a list of, well, here are the different, you know, we can say micro schools, we can say homeschools, we can say homeschool co-ops, but it's technology really expands all of those options, because you can make an education today basically whatever you want. I mean, you know, so to put these labels on it, I think is already very limiting, but I know, and I'm not trying to be contemptuous of your question, because I think it's important, you know, obviously, to give people a place to start in just some of these key terms that they might not even have heard of before that they can search for. But at the same time, I think it's equally important that people don't, because we heard this expression all the time during, you know, the COVID lockdowns, which was, homeschool isn't school at home. And I think that that's such an important reminder to all parents, even remotely considering alternative options, which is, please just don't reproduce the government school in a different location. Don't reproduce it in your home. Don't reproduce it in a church. You know, don't reproduce it in a micro school. It's like the form itself is a problem. So use the variety of resources that we have today, where there's absolutely no reason that a student needs to be forced to sit at a desk for 7 hours a day. Absolutely no reason whatsoever that one of the things that most parents find when they start to homeschool or even with micro schools is that kids need a heck of a lot less time actively engaged in an academic pursuit because they learn so much faster. They learn so much better when it's not being forced down their throats. And when they have some time to mix in academics with playtime and active time and work time and their own choice of activities. So all that, sorry, very long-winded explanation to say, just recognize that and read, you know, other people's experiences, I think, are a great place to begin with any of these things and see like, what are the, you know, what are some people doing and what can I take away from that? And then how can I apply that to what I know about my child, you know, what I know about how my child learns. And guess what? A great place to start is asking that question. How does my child learn? What are my child's true interests? And beginning from there, and then trying to match that up with an academic program, an educational learning program that is best suited to your child, right? Not that's best suited to the teacher or the bureaucrat.
I think that's really empowering. And it puts people back in the position of you have to now engage. It seems sometimes the parents and child are living alternate, you know, separate lives. And I know that I appreciated when things were structured for me, you know, that teachers expected something. It wasn't nebulous. They expected me to be my best. And that's another thing. This system that you just described shoots for the child to be their best, to find out what it is that they shine in and make that the focal point as opposed to one size fits all. Let's take our last break because I think you're giving people a place to start instead of just, it's too big, I don't know what I can do. I think it's one step at a time. So let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Carl Streitel. And before the break, you did just an amazing job to me of talking about what people need to, I guess, the nucleus of what it means to be, to know your child, to know what makes them shine and to help them grow in that way. I felt like I had so much support. I could make mistakes when I was growing up. I had support. I was expected to do my best. It wasn't what you couldn't do, it's what you're capable of doing. And this whole system seems to be what you just described for the first segment of a show, was how degrading and demoralizing it is, and it doesn't have to be. So from the parent standpoint, for those that are intimidated, because some people don't feel like they can teach their children, are there, you mentioned a couple of micro school platforms that people could use. What about teachers? Are there a consortium of teachers who used to teach in the public system and now gone on their own? Or you can, I don't know, hire them as a tutor or do a micro school through a teacher that you appreciate. Is it that decentralized?
Oh, yes, there certainly are. I think part of the problem, but also the solution, is because it is decentralized, it being this quote unquote alternative school movement, is that it is different for people. You know, they're used to having one point of contact that if I want to, you know, deal with school, I know where to go, right? There's the high school, there's the middle school, there's the elementary school. I know where to go and I relatively know to whom I should talk. But when it comes to this wild west of alternative education in the best sense of the word, in the best sense of the term, there isn't just one point of contact. You know, there's not one search engine. There's not one group. It's a variety of places. And so, yes, it is incumbent upon the parents to do the research. Now, thankfully, thanks to the internet, it isn't that difficult to do. I've mentioned before that I think a great place to start, I don't use it myself. I don't like, you know, Facebook, I don't have a need for it, but I think that it is a great resource for people who are trying to find alternatives in their local area for their children. And especially just for, as I mentioned before, ideas. I think that that's one of the most important places to start, is to just have ideas about what are some of the options that are available out there? What have other people been successful in so far and unsuccessful in as well, and what might work for my child. So I think that's a great place to start. I would also recommend, I think, you know, you mentioned before, are there teachers, you know, to whom you can reach out that you can bring in? And yes, absolutely. I know some of them, you know, might advertise in different ways. I had spoken to a family in North Carolina who, throughout various points in their son's education, he was homeschooled, they had signed him up for online classes with different teachers. They were live classes with various teachers in different parts of the country. And so I think that's, you know, a great way, right? You don't even need to have necessarily all these teachers right around you. They're a Zoom call or, you know, a Google Meet away. And so that can be a great way to do things. Now, how can you find them? Well, again, that's where a little bit of searching comes in. Unfortunately, right, there isn't just one website where you can go to find these things, but Facebook is a great resource. And just ask people, you know, join a homeschooling group and just ask them, hey, where, you know, I'm looking for someone to teach X or Y. And does anybody here know? And odds are you're going to get someone who can tell you real quickly, or someone or multiple people probably who are going to reach out to others they know. And right, then we can have truly a social network, for the name of the movie, and turn Facebook into, you know, what it was originally, well, semi-originally designed for, not picking up girls, but rather to, you know, hopefully bring people a little bit closer together in these groups. So I think that can be a great place to start. If you want something a little bit closer to home and maybe a little bit more personal and face-to-face, you could always look at, whether it's in the newspaper or just like on your local school district's website, look at the teachers who just retired and, you know, get in touch with them before they retire, since obviously it's pretty easy, right? They all have their email addresses on the website there. You know, get in touch with them before they actually leave the school in June and ask them, hey, would you be interested in, you know, tutoring my, or, you know, teaching my child for, you know, an X subject for, you know, these number of hours per week or whatever it is, and work something out. Because I know when I first retired, the biggest problem for me was finding that purpose, finding some kind of value, where I could hopefully be helpful to others. And I'm sure that I'm not alone in that feeling. So I think that, you know, there are many retired teachers out there who would be more than happy to get involved in projects like that. And they, probably much like the parents on the other side, are sort of equally adrift. You know, maybe they have that desire as well to do that, but they don't know how to connect. And so I think that it can be equally helpful for the parents to kind of reach out in that way too.
Well, in terms of the financial side of this, I mean, the money that's plowed, or should be poured, into the public education system from property taxes, et cetera, is really, it's prohibitive, and we're not getting what we're paying for sure. But what about payment? I mean, how much does it generally cost to pull your child out into one of like schools like Prenda or the micro schools? Is it being paid for by, let's say, the education savings account some states have? Are you able to get vouchers for this for people who, you know, economics count for everybody at this point? Is it something feasible that you can actually afford to do?
Yes, I think that. Obviously, well, let me add an asterisk to that. Obviously, it completely depends on the individual. It would be wildly inaccurate to just give a blanket yes that anybody can do this. No, of course, that's untrue. However, it is becoming more and more feasible by the day for hopefully just about everyone to be able to access one of these options. Now, I've challenged myself at various points to come up with a full educational program for less than $1,000. And I think that I've been able to do that. Now it is, you know, it would be a type of, you know, homeschool/homeschool co-op type of program. But if you're going to do something like that, it does not cost a lot of money. Now, recognize, of course, I'm ignoring, yes, you're not going to have two parents working at that point, but that can bring its own joys as well as obviously impediments too. But places like Prenda, for example, or Acton Academy, now it does vary from location to location, but on average, places like that and others to whom I have spoken, you're talking usually about in like the $6,000 to $8,000 per year range that they're charging for tuition. And many of these, especially the smaller ones, like, you know, the ones that are run by maybe just one person out of his or her home, almost always have some kind of graduated payment plan and or, you know, need-based payment where, you know, if you truly want to go to that school, I mean, I had, you know, one micro school founder tell me this in her own words, that she doesn't want to turn you away for financial reasons. And so, you know, she was going to find a way to get that child into her school and provide an education. So, you know, there are different ways to be able to do that. And yes, you mentioned vouchers and educational savings accounts, ESAs, are some of those methods. But I mean, really, you know, when it comes down to it, for a lot of people, not all, but for many people, you know, that's, you know, what the average car payment these days is, what, $800 or something, $700 a month. So, I mean, when you're talking about your children's education, $500 a month, I think that, you know, that could be doable for a lot of people if it's something that is obviously providing value. Now, of course, the best idea is to just end school property taxes altogether and let people keep that money and do what they want with it. But that's unfortunately probably a bit of a pipe dream. But, you know, for now, there are so many options. And again, as I said many times during this interview, individualization is the key. And each one of these micro schools, each one of these options is going to have individual financial requirements and individual financial allowances too. Different, you know, there are different grants that are available. And like I said, the founders themselves might be able to work something out with you. So there are a variety of ways to do it. But I mean, when it comes to homeschooling, if you're set on that, that can be done very, very inexpensively. And I think that that's something that should also be very attractive to, you know, to many parents out there. But, you know, if we compare that, just on a quick side note for your listeners, just to make sure everyone's clear on this, that, you know, because I know a lot of people hear $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, and they think, oh my goodness, that, you know, that's a lot of money because I pay $4,000 in school taxes. So that's already double what I pay in school taxes. And again, this is where, you know, the government does a great job of misleading people because, yeah, you may pay $4,000 in school taxes, but what's the per pupil cost in your school district? Well, the average around the country is almost $19,000. So, you know, it costs 19 grand a year for your kid to go to school. Now you're paying, you know, one quarter, not even, of that. You can also ask yourself how fair and how ethical that is, but that's a separate question. But, you know, if we do some quick math and say, you know, what, $19,000 times, what, 20 kids in a class, let's be very conservative. And so what's that, $380,000? So ask yourself that. If your kid's going to a local elementary school, is the teacher getting paid $380,000? I mean, so where's the rest of that money going? You know, if the teacher's making, let's say, 70, 80, even $100,000, like in the district where I worked, $120,000, that's like a third of the per pupil cost is actually going to the salary, you know, plus benefits of the teacher. So, you know, you have a lot of people in these micro schools who are working for $30,000, $40,000, you know, dollars a year because they truly do love what they're doing and because they truly do want to help kids. So I think that, you know, those options are becoming more and more economically feasible. And let's not forget the other one out there. I know this is very difficult for many people beyond homeschooling, but you can always start your own as well. And you could start it with your own kids. Start it with two or three of your neighbors, you know, who are like-minded, who are also looking for options. And you don't have to give up your job. What if you, you know, what if you and your two or three neighbors rotate? Could you, you know, work from home one day a week? Okay, well, you know, you get two or three of your neighbors and you have somebody who can do it Monday, Tuesday, somebody else who could do it Wednesday, Thursday, and then maybe you could do it on Fridays. And there you go, right? So this is what I mean by, you know, kind of thinking outside of the box, being creative and understanding what is actually going to be best for your children.
You left people with a call to action. How can people read what you write?
As you mentioned before, I do write occasionally on mentallab.substack.com. So that's a good place to find me.
Thank you. And thank you everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.